Unmute. There we go. My name is Merlin. I'm an alcoholic. This is weird. It's going to be tough without hearing y'all go, yay, Merlin. I got that big ego. I need people to like clap for me and stuff. I had said when the Zoom thing started becoming prevalent, like, I'm not going to do that. And it took a few weeks until I was like, well, I guess I'll be doing some Zoom meetings. And I went to some of these speaker meetings and I said, well, I'll do Zoom, but if anybody ever asks me to do one of these talks over Zoom, no way. Of course, when Chris asked me last week, it took me all of 2 seconds to say, well, okay. Because that's kind of what I do in AA usually, is say okay. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love recovery in all its forms. I found my freedom and I found the gift of recovery through AA. I also love NACA, all that stuff, though it's not where I go. I appreciate it. I'll never be that guy that you hear talk down on other fellowships or programs, or any group of people that's their purpose is to stay clean and help other addicts stay clean. I'm not going to be the guy that says, I don't think they're doing it right, though I do hear that kind of stuff. So I guess I got, 40 minutes or so to tell y'all about me, which it's going to be good for me at least, because I get to talk about what I love to talk about the most. I'm going to start, I'll take y'all way back to when I was younger. I'm born and raised right here in Austin. I'm a South Austin kid in Travis Heights. I went to Travis Heights Elementary, Fulmore Junior High, and Travis High School. I grew up there before you had to be rich to live there. My family was more kind of middle class. I think I had a pretty good family life, fairly normal. I mean, I've worked closely with enough alcoholics to know that I didn't have it near as bad as I used to think I did sometimes. In school, I know that I was that kid that I wasn't never quite with it, man. I wasn't ever stupid or anything, but I sure didn't know what was going on a lot of times. You know, and the teacher would come around and say, so what do you think about that, Merlin? I would say, huh? I just didn't quite get it. When I look around, all the other kids are writing, taking notes, and raising their hand. I was like, what are they doing? What are they, you know? So maybe I had ADD as bad as they said I had it. I'm not really sure. Unless it was something really interesting. I remember in health class, they called it when I was 7. They taught us about drugs, you know, marijuana, smoked, heroin, people inject it, cocaine and speed, people tend to snort it. They called it speed in the health book in 2nd grade. I remember I went home and I was intrigued by that, but I went right home and asked my mom, hey mom, what's the stuff that you snort, coke or speed? She said, speed. I don't like coke. Kind of like that. My dad was an alcoholic to the point where he'd get drunk and silly. And my mom divorced him when I was 3. And my stepdad moved into our house. And I thought he was a dick. Oh, pardon my French. That's one character defect I haven't quite gotten rid of. I still tend to cuss a little bit like a sailor sometimes. Maybe at some point I'll find it objectionable and stop, but it's probably not going to happen tonight. So now my stepdad, he was an alcoholic too, but not so much an alcoholic. You know, I come to find out years later, he was keeping his syringes hidden in the sock drawer or whatever. He liked to shoot up meth. My parents smoked a lot of weed though. To me, that seemed real normal. Like it probably seemed normal to a lot of you. I don't know. I kind of thought if you didn't smoke weed, you were weird. So when I was 11, that's the first time that I really remember getting high, smoking a joint. My real dad, who I'd stay with for a couple of days every other weekend, smoked a joint with me, and I remember he said, I wish it was like the 60s and we could just kick back and get really stoned. And I said, well, hell, Dad, it's the 80s. It's not much different. And my dad was pretty relaxed. You know, you're right, son. And so we smoked another joint. And I got really stoned, and I really liked it. And I had taken the roaches out of my parents' ashtrays and smoked them growing up, little kid. And I never really remember catching much of buzz, but that time I was high. And me and my dad made that a thing every 2 weeks when I had to stay at his house. We would get all stony baloney the whole time. Couldn't think of it. I remember asking him when I was with my ex-wife, and she had her kids. And when her oldest one was 11, I remember thinking, that's awfully young. And I asked my dad, why are you getting us high? Why were you getting me high when I was 11? He said, well, you were real mature for an 11-year-old. So I don't know if he knew what he was talking about. I guess I kind of got him back for it. I gave him his first hit of heroin when he was 65. So by the time that I was 14, 15, I got high every day. You know, mostly weed, party drugs on the weekend. I did coke, took acid, got in trouble, sold drugs. I did it because it was fun and I liked it, because school life was kind of boring. I wasn't into sports. I wasn't into any of the stuff kids were into. I rode my bikes and skateboards. I was into that. I thought I was cool and different, all that good stuff. And I didn't have a lot of consequences yet, but I started getting them when I was 15. I got arrested a couple times. I got kicked out of the school, you know, sent to the alternative learning center over on the east side for bad kids. And there the metal detectors went off on my cigarette pack, and I had a joint in there. So I got arrested at that school and kicked out of the Austin Independent School District. My mom sent me to a private school, this little place called Huntington, Surrey, that was downtown by UT. Kids were kind of different there. They had, you know, leather jackets and, you know, 16-year-old kids with a bunch of tattoos and mohawks and shit. And that was pretty cool, but I lasted maybe a month before I got kicked out of there for selling drugs to the other kids at the school. Now, the court system, the juvenile court, sent me to inpatient rehab around that age. And I was doing this teen and family counseling center thing that my parents got all involved in. And that's when I first got introduced to AA. I remember thinking, too, like, man, that life's gotta suck, man. I feel sorry for you guys going to these AA meetings. But I was 15. They told my mom, who she'd done her fair share of drugs, but they told all of us, you know, if you want your family to be healthy, and my stepdad, that all y'all are going to need to stop getting high. And for my mom, who I thought got high as much as me and my stepdad, she just quit. And me and my dad, we couldn't just quit like that. My mom had had enough, and she kicked me and my dad out. Me and my stepdad, I mix them up a lot. I was real close to both my dads, so if I say dad, I might be talking about one or the other. You know, they're kind of a little bit the same. And my mom stayed there with my older brother. I had a brother who was 3 years older than me, which kind of sucked because half of my wardrobe always came from him and already had holes in it growing up. That's what they did in the 80s, you know. So when my mom went to Al-Anon and said she had had enough and kicked me and my dad out, my dad kind of lost his shit, you know, got an apartment, and I thought he lost his shit. He done went crazy and went to Bolden and got sober. What's wrong with that guy? And me, I didn't do that. I kind of went off the deep end, like, well, shit, if I'm not going to live at home, I can party all I want. And I got an apartment with friends and partied my ass off and started getting in a lot more trouble. had the juvenile court send me back to rehab again and, you know, lock me up. I was fortunate. My mom would drive up to the court and say, don't send him to the TYC or whatever. Let's please get this kid into rehab. And they're pretty, if your parents come cut for you when you go to the juvenile, they'll usually keep you out of the juvenile prison and let your parents pay for you to go to rehab or something like that. So I was doing that and I was back in school. I made it to the 10th grade. I didn't really know why everybody didn't want me to get high. It really bothered me. I couldn't see anything wrong with what I was doing. But when I got really bad, when things took a turn for the worse, was the day they came and pulled me out of school. I'll never forget. Actually, it was today, the 1st? It was October 31st, Halloween. They pulled me out of school. My dad told me my older brother had died from alcohol poison. And that would be like 28 years ago, I guess, yesterday. And I was completely destroyed, crushed. People thought I drank a lot before that. I bought a bottle of Crown Royal, I remember that night, and I drank it, and I blacked out. And the next day when I woke up, I didn't remember anything from the night before. And that's when I realized, you know, in the bottle, I had the power to forget. Sorry about that. And that was all I wanted, just to forget. So for the first time, I wasn't really drinking just to have fun. I was drinking to be obliterated, to be unconscious. And I did it a lot every day. And I took a lot of pills too. Y'all remember Rohypnol was popular back then? The date rape drug, they call it. And I never used it to date rape anybody. I wasn't sharing. I was eating them myself. That and the Valium and the Xanax and lots of alcohol. I started getting in car crashes and shit. I got in a lot of trouble from, I think I was age 16 and a half till age 17 and a half. I crashed into a house with some pounds of weed in the back of my car. That was my first felony. I got my first DWI, trespassing charge, you know, minor in possession of alcohols, all the little shit, you know, more marijuana possession charge. And then I got the robbery case. I kept bonding out, you know, we're young and invincible. And I was always so wasted. I go to jail and I'd give them 500 or 1,000 bucks and I'd get out. And I thought, well, this is no big deal. It seems like whatever I do, I'm just going to give them some money and I'll get out. I never looked at the letters that came in the mail that said I had to go back to court. I didn't pay any attention to that shit. I had no idea what the justice system entailed. So when all that caught up with me, I was 17. They locked me up for about a year and sent me through that SMART program. I got out of there and I lasted about, I don't know, 2 months before they locked me back up. And this time they sent me out to the ranch. And then from the ranch, they sent me to the McCabe Center, which is a little different back then. I stayed there for 11 months. And that's where I kind of got my second little dose of what was going on in the rooms of recovery. I got a couple sponsors. I never worked any steps. I remember I had this French sponsor. You never think about these things. There's a lot of things you don't remember or think about till years later when I finally got sober and started going over my past history and life. I remembered things that I hadn't thought about in years. I remember that French guy, you know, some of y'all have had sponsees like this. Or you've been that sponsor. You get a sponsor, you don't work any steps, but you call them every 3 weeks when you have a problem. Bro, my life sucks, dude. Man, my girlfriend is. And being in recovery, like, I'll tell him, well, we probably ought to do some step work around this. I remember that French guy would be like, if you don't work the fucking steps, you're going to fucking drink. I remember it today ever so clearly, but I didn't hear it until I was 40 when I got sober. I was wondering where that dude is. Anyways, after 11 months in the McCabe Center, I enjoyed being sober and I enjoyed the fellowship at that time, but I still wasn't quite right. You know, I had that thing that some of us alcoholics got. My natural state of being is just not quite right. I'm a little bit uncomfortable with things. I never got connected to the fellowship because I stayed separated. I didn't look at what was similar between me and these guys. I looked at that. I'm 20 years old. Y'all are a lot older. You got 3-4 DWIs. You're stupid. These guys been to prison 3 times. I quit before I go to prison 3 times. You know, we always say, I'll never do what those guys did. So I'm glad AA is here for all of y'all, but I don't know if this is quite for me. And when you're talking about my choices to go on to the bitter end or accept spiritual help, well, okay, I'm going to go look for door number 3 because it's out there. I know I'm right because I'm always right. That's another trait some of us alcoholics have. You know, we're always right about everything. And so I did. When I got out of the McCabe, I started drinking again. And alcoholism was what's progressive, right? And progressive in a lot of ways. Progressive is in I started drinking a whole lot more, a lot faster, and a lot more often to get where I wanted to be. And I started adding a lot of more substances to the mix to get to feeling how I wanted to feel, because alcohol alone didn't quite do it for me. Some other progressive things about alcoholism were how much I would get arrested, and how long they would keep me, and in some cases how far away they would send me. Some other things would be how much that I would hurt the people that I love the most, how much I would hurt everybody around me. You know, I got married and I had a son that was 3 years old when I went to prison. This was, I don't know, he's 15 now. And I remember being in the prison, you know, writing letters like, oh, I got to change my life, man. There's this whole added thing of having a kid that being in jail when I was younger sucked. You know, it already sucks bad enough, but leaving your kids out here sucks really bad. And so I was like, I'm not going to do this ever again. And I would write that in the letters, and I'd write my dad, my mom, and everybody believed me. Like, I think Merlin's really going to change. And they believed me because I was telling the truth. I meant it. You know, I say this sometimes. My dad, I'm sure I've told some of y'all this story. My dad was an English teacher who quit because he wanted to drink and drive a cab instead. But he would take my letters from prison, and I just thought this was funny, and cross the T's and dot the I's with a red pen and put exclamation point and mail them back to me. He was silly. But anyways, I got out of prison that time, and it took me, you know, a matter of days before I got high. I thought I was going to be good, you know, and I'm a heroin and meth addict. I shoot up meth and heroin every day. That's what I do. And I thought I'd just kind of, you know, shoot heroin on the weekends. And I was pretty good at it, actually. I got away with just shooting heroin on the weekends for probably like 6 months. Don't ask me how. But then I started snowballing downhill again. Me and the wife I was with got a divorce. I met Jennifer, lovely lady that some of y'all know. She went through AR. And then my daughter was born, my daughter Mila, who's 7 years old now. And when she was 8 months, and I guess my son was 7, I went back to prison. And I thought, fuck, man, I swore I wasn't going to do this again. I'm not sure where along the road I went wrong and wound up back here, but not again. And I did the same thing. I wrote the letters, but this time I meant it. I absolutely was changing my life. My mom picked me up in Huntsville. Can't remember when this was, but it was when I got out. I know I got out on April 1st. I made parole. I thought it was a joke. I was like, I wonder if they're going to let me out. It's some kind of April Fool's joke. But my mom drove me home, and we talked in the car on the way home, and I was like, yeah, Mom, I really made some changes. I really had some growth. Well, you know, people say this, you know, grow and change in prison. I didn't learn shit. I went to some little AA and NA meetings while I was in there, but there was very different than the ones out here. The message, they just didn't quite carry the message. That or I wasn't willing to hear it. Probably the latter. But it's a beautiful day, and I drove home when my mom drove me home, and I was in the car telling her how good I was going to be, how life was going to be different, and I stepped out of the car, the same house I grew up in Travis Heights, and how does the big book say? A beautiful day, not a cloud in the horizon. I stepped out of the car, my mom's neighbor, the old biker dude, Merlin, where you been? Oh, you been in prison? Oh, shit, you're clean then, huh? I said, yep, sure am. He said, you want to get high? I said, well, yeah. Like, what the fuck? So I had all these aspirations of not getting high, but what did I, that mental blank spot. And whenever I relapsed, you know, when I get high again, I've been clean for a while. It always happens one of a few ways. Either it's just like that, my mind doesn't come with sufficient force, the memories of 4 hours ago when I got out of prison, or a week or a month or any time, consequences don't keep me sober. It doesn't matter how bad shit happens, I forget all about it without even thinking about it. It's either that, or I've been clean, I've been out of rehab for a while, I've been to rehab several times, and I start thinking, well, maybe I was being a little bit drastic, maybe I can get high, I mean, I could just smoke a joint. You know, so I changed my mind, right? If alcoholism centers in the mind, I have to wonder if I'm really the one making that decision. Is it really me that changed my mind? I don't know. That, or it also happens like this. I seem to be doing okay, and I got a job, and I got my family back with me, and I have a car and even a driver's license, and things are going okay, and I'm just not quite right. I have everything that a man needs to be okay. The family, good relationship with my mom. On the outside, everything looks real good, but I haven't taken care of what's in here, right? I don't take care of this. I take care of my driver's license, and I think I understand what the first step says. Yeah, my life's unmanageable. I got to take care of my court cases, fucking clear out these pawn tickets, put money back in here instead of fucking unpaid pawn tickets. Drive legally, and I take care of all that stuff. And I'm still not okay, and it starts to get kind of painful. And they say, you know, the craving is physical. The mental, the obsession is mental. To me, it feels real physical. It starts to hurt so bad. And anybody that's ever been, you know, had somebody close to you die or been broke up with by a girl, you know what that's like. You feel like you've been punched in the stomach. Your heart hurts. It's painful. And for me, it gets painful. So much to the point where I got the needle in the rig and I say, fuck, I know this is going to end badly. Hope it doesn't end as bad as it did last time, but, you know, drugs treat my addiction, alcohol treats my alcoholism, and I don't know what else to do except hope that it goes not too freaking bad, and slam, I'm off to the races. And it's always one of those three ways. The last relapse when I got out of prison, it just happened to be that mental blank spot, and that was the one that took me out, that led to me getting sober. Is when I got out of prison and I partied my ass off and I snowballed downhill. I had my wife mad at me all the time. When I knock on my mom's door, she would look at me and say, when are you going to stop being such an effing loser? Just shut the door. That one hurts because I'm a mama's boy. You know, I talk about how much we hurt the people I love. I'd go to my mom's house because my wife would kick me out because I wouldn't come home. And I remember falling out on her floor and donking my head. And the next day, my mom, you know, cleans up the syringes and throws them away and says, you know how it feels? My mom's a nurse. You know, I have to take your pulse and see if you're still alive. I already had my other son die from alcoholism. And I can't know how that feels. I know for me, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, right? Which was a good place for me to be. I used to visit this treatment center, and they would have a group in one room and a group in another room. They would say, which treatment center do you want to go to? Send me the ones where the guys suffered pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Those are the ones I want to talk to. But anyways, so I got arrested 5 months after getting out of prison, a fresh heroin and meth case, because I was trying to be a good kid. When my wife would kick me out, I'd pull up a couple houses down from my mom's and say, well, I'm going to get loaded in the car real quick because I don't want to accidentally fall out, hit my head, and have my mom all, you know, taking my pulse or die in front of her. Well, the neighbor lady didn't like me passing out in front of her house, and the cops woke me up and arrested me. And there I was back in jail on parole, like, fuck, man. And fortunately, my parole officer was cool, said, you're just a junkie getting high. I'm not going to lock you up, man. And I got out, and I'm back to reporting to my PO, but life sucks. I got CPS cases. I'm not allowed to see my kids. Nobody wants to be around me. You know, my wife went into AR. She's in there hanging out with Chris. And she took the baby, you know, that's the only way she was allowed to see the baby. My son, I had sent off to live with his grandparents on his mother's side, you know, 9 months before that, cause, or maybe 6 months before that, because I got out of prison, and within 2 weeks, I was like, well, I'm supposed to have my kid, but I better give him up because I already can't take care of him. And so life, you know, it's easy. Not easy, but I'll say us addicts, we know what it's like to adjust our expectations, you know. You know, life's never not going to be that good for me. That's just the way it is. I'm gonna learn to be all right with it. I'm going to have a shitty job and a shitty car and probably a shitty house. I'm never going to be able to afford much. I can deal with that. Or, you know, I'm going to send my kids off to live with their grandparents. At least they're being taken care of. But it's real hard to adjust to, you know, my mom slams the door in my face. I feel like shit all the time. I hurt everybody I love over and over and over again, and my heart hurts, and I'm in pain, and this sucks, and I still can't stop. My cars are wrecked. You know, as we say, we seek AA recovery with all the desperation of a drowning man. I was fucking drowning, and I think of this analogy sometimes. Have you ever seen those Sylvester the cat with the little mouse, and Sylvester the cat's floating on the raft, and the mouse is shooting a slingshot, and it's poking holes in the raft, and he sticks one finger in, and then another finger, and the mouse is keeps shooting holes in it. That's how I was like, and then I run out of fingers and toes, and I'm drowning in financial problems, legal problems, relationship problems, my mom hates me problems, my wife hates me problems, CPS wants to kick my ass and take my kids, and I'm fucking drowning, and it hurts real bad all the time. And my parole officer is like, dude, what the fuck are you going to do? I keep telling him, I'm going to go to rehab, dude. And when I come see him the next month, he's like, why aren't you in rehab yet? Well, bro, I don't know. You know how we do. I'm still waiting on a bed, man. And, you know, my mom would be like, whatever happened to that rehab? I thought you were going to rehab. Call him. And I call him, hey, I'm going to the bed. And, you know, the rehab, yeah, we're ready for you. Mom, they said it's going to be 3 more weeks. You know, they're ready right then. This last time I saw my parole officer, he said, well, I got somewhere to send you. He said, I'm tired of bullshitting with you. I can't just let you keep living like this. You know, my arms were full of holes. I was 150 pounds. I'm 210 now. I looked bad. And he said, I got somewhere to send you when you come back in 2 weeks. You won't go to this rehab you're supposedly say you're going to. And that was a Thursday, and I called the rehab when I got out. I was like, hey, guys, I'm serious now. I'm really in a hurry. You know, as bad as shit gets, I still need that extra little push. And then I went to Centicorn, Waco. That was a Thursday. Centicorn, Waco said, yeah, we're ready for you. How about tomorrow? I said, oh, shit. Now that's a little bit too soon. They said, how about Monday? I said, how about Tuesday? You know, we're going to ride this out just a little while longer, right? As bad as shit got, give me one more weekend to see if things get better. You know, silly us. And so I turned myself in. My awesome mom drove me up there. Fortunately, she has to pee a lot because I got to stop at every truck stop and shoot up in my feet on the way up there. I was grateful for that at the time. And so after I got done with detox, fortunately, I was a place that had one side for detox and rehab on the other side. And I went into a 30-day program after about 10 days. And I started reading a big book again for the second time. I hadn't read it in 20 years, but it was completely as if this book was written just for me. Like, I identified with everything it said. It made perfect sense. When I read that book, I didn't think, man, these people are silly. When the AA guys came in and talked to us and give us those little talks, I didn't look at them and think, boy, it must suck to be you guys. I thought, man, I saw myself in every one of those guys. And the NA guys, too, they all carried a message of hope. Those NA guys said, well, they say, we carry the message that any addict anywhere can stay drug-free and lose the desire to use. I thought, fuck, that's great. How do I get that? But it was the AA guys that really stuck out to me, maybe because my dad got sober in AA and was 23 years sober when he died. Maybe it was, I don't know, but they made sense. And so I was willing to pay attention and do anything. So I got out of that rehab. I went to the Oxford House. And I started going to AA meetings every day. I dove right in because I had to admit that I could not find door number 3. And I almost died trying to prove I was right. And that's you know, characteristic of an alcoholic, right? I don't want to admit I'm not right. I hate to admit I might not be right by asking for help. You know what I mean? Damn, we only learn through experience. I had to go through it. You know, you can't tell me nothing. So I got a sponsor real quick. And I started doing the step work. My sponsor said, well, read the first 43 pages of the big book and come back. We're going to talk about the first step. I called him the next day. All right, I'm coming back over when you get off work. I'll be there. You know, I wasn't wasting no time. Damn, you ready? My sponsor to this day says, yeah, you're the best sponsor I ever had. And I got a couple like that too. And I fucking love those guys. Anyways, you know, the second step, be willing to, or come to believe, or at least be willing to. We assure you you're on our way. Well, shit, I'm on my way. I'm willing to believe any fucking thing. I'll accept spiritual help. And I got into the inventory writing process, and I didn't really quite know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was doing going through any of the steps. The third step, selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my problem. I don't think so. I buy guys at the bar beer. I'm fucking friendly. I'm not selfish. You know how we do? Not thinking about the selfishness of not coming home where my wife and kids are for 2 days. No, I'm being good. I gave this dude a ride. You know, fucking delusional, right? So I took a closer look at all that stuff. You know, the fourth step was kind of powerful for me. And then the fact, like, I was still pissed off at my mom. I thought she was a bitch for bringing my mean-ass drug addict stepdad into the house. Well, when I take a closer look at it, you know, kicking me out when I was 15, I take a closer look at it like I was a real difficult kid. And my stepdad, who was 23 years sober when he died, through my whole life, was the one guy that I was closest to in the whole world that understood me better than anybody else, that I could call crying and sad. And he would say, Merlin, I love you. Man, I know what you're going through. It's not the end of the world. He might have saved my life. I don't know. So thank God my mom brought that guy into my life. I don't know why I spent the last 20 years being pissed off that she did. That's fucking weird. So it didn't, you know, it just takes this little bit of work to look at things from a different angle. And I look at a lot of things from a different angle. It's that pattern that I've developed. And I started getting connected to people. What do I got, like 5 minutes, right? Yeah. I started getting 5 or 10. Okay. So I started getting connected to people. My sponsor, every time somebody would get a chip, a 30-day chip, a 60-day chip, a year, it didn't matter. He'd say, go over and talk to that dude, shake their hand, or stand out by the front door of the meeting, and everybody that walks in here, I want you to introduce yourself. And I thought, well, that's a really bad idea. I don't know any of these people. But I did it anyways, because I'm going to do what my sponsor said. I trusted him. He did 10 more years in prison than me, and he stayed out there shooting heroin for 20 years longer than me. You know, we like to find somebody that we believe was way worse than us, and they somehow climbed out of it, and they're doing way better than us now. That's the dude that can help me. Us AA people, we look for stone-cold, raggedy-ass dope fiends that were down the gutter and ask them, show me how to do good. It's freaking weird, right? But that's how it works. That's a beautiful thing about AA. So I went to a lot of meetings every day, got connected to a lot of people. I needed that comfort. Every single person in the rooms of AA at that point in time knew how to stay sober better than I did. And I desperately needed to stay sober. So I wanted to be around that stuff all the time. I didn't really know where else to be. I just wanted to soak up all the juice I could get, you know, and the longer I stay sober, and I do it still today, I hear things that I haven't heard before, little suggestions, and maybe I can apply that to my life. I'm usually kind of reluctant if it requires me doing any kind of work. Like, fuck, man, that means I got to do like more writing and shit. Like, I'm going to wait on that one. But I'm real big on the prayer and meditation. The men's process is real powerful for me. You know, I come out of the other end of my four-step looking at, you know, the people I'm resentful at and realizing, fuck, I owe them a huge amends, like my mom, my old boss who had fired me. I owed him an amends. You know, I had to take him back some of his tools and a couple $100 for some, I was a contractor building fences for some pickets I stole. He said, what do you give me $200 for? Man, when I worked here last year, I stole some of those wood pickets and built some of my own shit. Oh, I'm sure you meant to bring them back. No, dude, I didn't mean to bring them back. I stole them. He was like, huh? Well, that's weird, Merlin. I don't do that thing where my sponsor had these little cards, you know, I'm an addict in recovery, and I don't do that. I just go make my amends kind of on a more, you know, less nerdy level. Whatever gets you there, right? That's the way I see it. my dad, when he got sober, he had this metal detector. He used to dig gold out of the ground. He got all nerdy and shit. And he melted this gold down and made this ring with a G on it. His name was Gary, and I called him G. And before he died, he gave it to me, and I pawned it. And I could never get it out. My mom asked me for it over and over. What'd you do with that thing? I don't know, Mom. I took it off because I was welding. I can't find it. I remember telling my sponsor, I was like, I got to make amends to my mom for, you know, a whole onslaught of bullshit I did, but I got to tell her about this ring thing, which in my opinion, that was the worst thing I ever did. And I did a lot of bad shit, but stealing shit from my mom, hey, Jacob, was fucking the worst thing that was the thing I felt the most guilt and shame about. And I had went by my mom's house a couple times. I was like, yeah, Bobby, that's my sponsor. I was like, I can't bring myself to say nothing to her. I said, besides that, my mom's pretty mean. She's going to slap the shit out of me. And I called him. That was the third time I was going over there. So that way I couldn't back out of it, right? Didn't call him the first two times. And he said, well, bro, he said, what you do is you sit down and tell your mom that you pawned the ring and you didn't get it out. Don't make no excuses. Clench your jaw and close your eyes and wait for her to slap the shit out of you. I said, well, fuck. Okay. I guess I'll do that. It's kind of a hard ass, I guess. Well, my mom didn't slap the shit out of me, fortunately. She started crying, and, you know, I've asked her what I could do to make these things up to her, and she's never given me a list or told me anything, but I damn sure, you know, she's had a couple operations, knee operations, bad joints, and I go take her to the hospital, be there for all the appointments, stay the night at her house. That first, I stayed at her house for 10 days when she got out of the hospital. I think it was about day 10. She was like, Merlin, you could leave now. I certainly wasn't going to ask because she had went to the hospital before when I was using. I took her in the hospital. I brought her home, and then I seen her get up and go outside and smoke a cigarette for a knee surgery. And I said, shit, she just walked all the way in the kitchen. Fuck her. I burned off. I got to go. I got to get high. When she got her neck surgery and I was high, I found out when I took her the one in sobriety. I said, what do you mean you had your hip operated on too? Why didn't you call me? She said, I knew you would have just took off. I was like, ugh. So now I show up. My mom wants anything, I show up. So maybe she never told me what she wants, but she's damn happy for me. One of my mom's friends texted me not long ago, said, yeah, ask your mom how you're doing. She said, you're fucking awesome. And that's a good feeling. And, you know, I think the 12 step is important. I sponsored a lot of guys, and I still do. I was working with one today out at the park. Nothing so much ensures immunity from drinking like intense work with alcoholics, right? It works where other activities fail. And that goes for all my obsessive thinking. I do a lot of things to relieve stress. I ride my bike. I walk my dog. You know, I do a lot of meditation. I'm real big on meditation. But when I'm cloudy in the head, which I am often, and overly stressed out, nothing works better than working with other alcoholics. Nothing works better than getting simply out of myself and helping other people. It's absolutely crucial. And I'll say, out of all the guys that I sponsored, the ones that went through the steps and got sponsees and started working with them, all those guys are still sober. And the ones that I've worked with that got sober and went kind of through the steps and got to the 8th step and put on the brakes and don't start sponsoring other guys, all those people are out drinking, with the exception of one or two, and I don't really know how good they're doing. I don't really talk to them. So it can be done, but I wouldn't risk it. Besides that, just the way it feels, how awesome it is to have purpose. We know that money don't buy happiness, but having a bigger purpose and helping others seems to generate some happiness. And so I could tell you what transpires all day long in recovery. You know, I have cars and a house, and my kids live with me, which is a beautiful thing. I have insurance on my cars. I don't have legal problems. Regular shit that to the neighbors, it's like, well, he got a Mercedes. You know, he's doing better than me. That's just normal shit. But to a guy like me, if you felt the way I felt and thought the shit I thought and drank the way I drank and was as hopeless and broke down as we were, and now I just get to live in a normal neighborhood doing normal shit with my kids, to me, it's a fucking miracle. When I get to kiss my kids goodnight, I mean, I say this all the time. My old ass pillow is way softer than any pillow I could buy, because I sleep like a baby now. And all I ever really wanted out of life for the last 20 years was just to be enough, right? To just be okay, just a little bit okay, just to not want to stick a needle in my arm all the time and to just be okay. And I got so much more than that. I can't even describe what the tingle is that I get in here when I'm thinking about just how badass normal life is. And yeah, it can suck sometimes, but like, not really. I'm not that guy that has a lot of problems. In recovery, I stay active and involved, and life gets better. I live with integrity every day, and life gets a little better. I stay in the solution to my problems. And fortunately, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous so far has had the solution to every one of my problems. I'm not that dude that struggles with wanting to drink. That hasn't happened to me yet. I'm very fortunate, because I'm definitely one of us. Somehow I've avoided that. Anyways, I don't want to over talk and run this clock out, so I'm gonna let us wrap up here. But hey, thank y'all so much for letting me talk. So I could just, like, I get on a roll and I run the clock out, but I know when I'm doing these things, and when I got other people doing them, I get real mad when they're supposed to be done at, you know, 8:30, and then I'm looking at the clock and it's like 8:35, and no matter how good all the shit they said, I'm like, fuck everything that dude said, keeping me an extra 5 minutes, you know? So thank you guys very much.
There you go, Merlin.
That was so great, Merlin.
Yes. Awesome, Merlin.
Good job, Merlin.
Well, thanks for having me.